Since word-by-word commentary of Surat al-Fatiha are available in the English language, it will not be covered in this book. The reader is encouraged to study the promised Messiah alayhi salam's commentary on Surat al-Fatiha, titled Commentary on the Holy Quran, Volume 1, Surah Fatiha, and Hazrat Muslim Aud radiallahu anhu's commentary on Surah Fatiha, available in At-Tafsirul Kabir, The Grand Exegesis. A brief introduction to Surat al-Fatiha is provided below. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Ar-Rahmanir Rahim. Maliki Yawmiddin. Iyaka Na'budu wa Iyaka Nasta'in. Ihdina Sirat al-Mustaqim. Sirat al-Lazina An'amta Alayhim. Ghayril Maghdubi Alayhim Waladhwalin. In the name of Allah, the Gracious, the Merciful. All praise belongs to Allah, Lord of all the worlds, the Gracious, the Merciful, Master of the Day of Judgment. Thee alone do we worship, and Thee alone do we implore for help. Guide us on the right path, the path of those on whom Thou hast bestowed Thy blessings, those who have not incurred displeasure, and those who have not gone astray. Explaining the qualities of Surat al-Fatiha, the promised Messiah alayhi salam said, "It should be clear that if a discourse fully resembles something from among the things that have proceeded from God and are the handiwork of His power of creation, that is to say, it combines in it the external and internal wonders in the same way that they exist in something that has been created by God, it can be said that such a discourse possesses the rank that is beyond the human capabilities to produce its like. For if it is admitted and approved by all and sundry, without any disagreement or controversy, that something is incomparable and has proceeded from God, then anything that is proven to fully share its criteria of incomparability would also be considered incomparable. For instance, if one object conforms in all aspects to another object which measures 10 yards, then it would be established with absolute certainty and beyond any doubt that it also measures 10 yards. Now, out of the things created by Allah, I shall, for the purpose of comparison, select one lovely creation, namely the rose, and describe the external and internal wonders which make it admittedly of such excellent quality that human capacities fall utterly short of reproducing its like. I shall then prove that the wonders and excellences of Surat al-Fatiha are in all respects of the same measure, and indeed far superior, as the wonders and excellences of the rose. The reason for selecting this illustration is that on one occasion, in a state of vision, my humble self saw that I was holding in my hand Surat al-Fatiha inscribed on a leaf, and it was so beautiful and attractive that it appeared as if the paper on which Surat al-Fatiha was written was laden with soft red rose petals, to the extent that it was beyond count. As my humble self recited any verse of this surah, many of these roses flew upwards, producing a sweet sound. The flowers were very delicate, large, beautiful, fresh, and full of fragrance. As they ascended, my heart and mind were perfumed with their fragrance, and they created such a state of intoxication that due to the attraction of their incomparable pleasure, they created a strong aversion from the world and all that is in it. This vision indicates that the rose has a spiritual affinity with Surat al-Fatiha. Due to this affinity, I chose it for the purpose of illustration. Therefore, it seems pertinent to delineate first, for illustration, the external and internal wonders found in the rose, and then set out the external and internal wonders of Surat al-Fatiha, so that the honest readers should know that the external and internal beauties of the rose, which put reproduction of its like beyond human reach, are present in Surat al-Fatiha in the same way, indeed with much greater beauty. And also, I chose it so that through this illustration, what was signified in the vision is carried out. Therefore, bear in mind that every sensible person would readily consider it to be a proven fact beyond any doubt that a rose, like other creations of God, has such excellent beauties within it, the like of which man is unable to reproduce. These beauties are of two types. First, those that are found in its external form, namely, its color is beautiful and lovely. Its fragrance is delightful and pleasing, and in its visible form, it is characterized by extreme delicacy, freshness, softness, tenderness, and purity. Second, there are beauties that the all-wise God has granted it internally, namely, the qualities which are hidden within its essence, and these are that it is refreshing, strengthens the heart, alleviates the bile, and invigorates all faculties and spirits. It is a laxative for yellow bile and watery phlegm. Similarly, it strengthens the stomach, liver, kidneys, intestines, womb, and lungs. Moreover, it is very beneficial for severe palpitation, fainting, and weakness of the heart. Similarly, it is beneficial for a variety of other ailments of the body. On account of these two types of qualities, it is believed that it is at such a level of perfection that it is utterly impossible for any human being to reproduce such a flower by himself, which is attractive in color, lovely in fragrance, and fresh, soft, delicate, and clear like the rose in its texture, and in addition, possesses internally all of those qualities that are possessed by the rose. If it is asked why it is believed about the rose that human powers are unable to create its match, and why it is impermissible for any man to be able to produce its like and create in an artificial flower all of the external and internal qualities that are found in the rose, then the answer to this question is, the possibility of producing such a flower has been refuted in practice, and until today, no physician or philosopher has been able to discover through the use of any device any kinds of medicines which, by their mixing or compounding, result in producing, externally and internally, the like of the rose in appearance and essence. It must be realized that the same aspects of incomparability are not only found in Surat al-Fatiha, but also in every brief passage of the Noble Quran, even one comprising less than 4 verses. First, observe its external form to see the perfect manifestation of elegance of diction, beautiful composition, excellent choice of words, perfectly smooth style, softness and fluidity, glamour, loveliness, and other qualities that are essential for a good composition, a manifestation that cannot possibly be exceeded and which is entirely secure and free from every kind of crude expression and complicated composition. Every phrase is the utmost in lucidity and eloquence, every form of expression is employed at its proper place, and everything that is necessary to enhance the beauty and bring out the loveliness of its composition is found in it. The highest grade of eloquence and beauty of articulation that can be imagined is found and seen in perfection, and all of the beauty of expression that is needed to make its meaning clear and pleasing is available and present therein. With all of the qualities of clarity of expression and conformity with the perfect beauty of diction, it is filled with the fragrance of truth and rectitude. In it, there is no exaggeration, having the slightest adulteration or falsehood, nor is there any figurative expression which, like that of the poets, is aided by the filth of falsehood, vain talk, or idle boasts. Wherever the composition of poets is laden with the stench of falsehood, idle boasts, and vain verbiage, this composition is full of the delicate fragrance of truth and rectitude. Furthermore, this fragrance is accompanied by a beauty of exposition, propriety of diction, figurativeness, and clarity of expression. And, as in the rose, its fragrance is accompanied by the beauty of its color and purity. These are its external qualities. As for internal properties, it, that is Surat al-Fatiha, has the following qualities. It encompasses remedies for grave spiritual ailments, and it contains a vast provision for the perfection of the faculties for theoretical and practical activities. It sets straight many serious disorders. It sets forth vistas of wisdom, deep subtleties, and fine points which remain hidden from the eyes of sages and philosophers. Its perusal fortifies the power of conviction in the heart of a spiritual pilgrim and heals the ailment of doubts, misgivings, and misguidance. Its blessed text is replete with countless supreme truths and very subtle verities which are essential for the perfect development of the human being. Obviously, these excellences are such that, like the perfect qualities of the rose, it is impossible for them to be combined in the composition of any human being. This impossibility is not mere speculation, but an established fact, because God Almighty has expounded the subtleties and splendid points of wisdom in this eloquent and lucid word precisely in the hour of their true need, displaying perfection in both external and internal qualities, and thus achieved perfection with profound fine details in both external and internal aspects. In other words, it first lays down the essential lofty divine insights, the traces of which had been lost and obliterated from earlier teachings, and no sage or philosopher had so much as hinted at them. Moreover, these divine insights have not been expounded in an unnecessary and redundant manner, but have been set forth at a time and in an age when such remedial measures were directly needed for the reformation of that time. Had they not been stated, the ruin and destruction of the age was inevitable. Again, these lofty divine insights have not been stated in a deficient and incomplete manner. Rather, they are situated at the point of perfection, both quantitatively as well as qualitatively. The intellect of no wise man can alight upon a religious verity that has been left out of them, nor is there any doubt of a follower of falsehood that has not been dispelled in this word. To expound all of these truths and sublime verities, which nevertheless fully conform with the true needs, and to do so with such unsurpassable excellence of eloquence and elegance, is indeed a grand task, evidently beyond the reach of human capacity. But man is so inept that if he wants to describe even the insignificant and trivial affairs that have nothing to do with sublime truths in an elegant and eloquent composition, with strict regard to truthfulness and veracity, it would not be possible for him. This is very obvious to any wise person. For example, take the case of a storekeeper who possesses great mastery of language both in poetry and prose, and wishes to maintain in his converse, which he has to make with all types of customers and clients, the highest standards of eloquence and figurative language, adapting his conversation with due regard to each occasion and situation, being brief when brevity is appropriate, and speaking in detail when argumentation is required. And if a dispute arises between him and a customer, adopting a way of speech that directs the argument towards his own benefit. Take next the case of a judge whose duty is to write most accurately the statements of both parties and witnesses, and then to duly analyze and criticize each statement, limiting himself to what is really needed with reference to the point at issue, as required for the examination of the case and appropriate for the investigation of the matters under dispute. It is expected that he should raise appropriate questions and duly record the answers and state the relevant facts. He should, as needed, cite applicable legal provision in accordance with the intent of the law. He should systematically expound the events, where needed, in their proper sequence and accuracy, and then give his verdict along with supporting arguments with the utmost precision. With all this, his writings should be at such a high degree of lucidity and elegance that they are unsurpassable by any other man. Obviously, such elegance is not achievable in the above cases. This is the state of human eloquence. They cannot even take the first step without all sorts of vain, unnecessary, and trivial words, and cannot even say a word without resorting to lies and useless talk. Even when they say something, it is incomplete. If the nose is present, as it were, the ears are not, and if the ears are there, the eyes are gone. Strict adherence to facts impairs the elegance of expression, and concern for elegance of expression may result in piles of falsehood and irrelevance, like an onion, layer after layer of shell, but nothing inside. In short, when sane reason clearly dictates the impossibility of stating even insignificant and unimportant matters and simple events in an elegant and eloquent composition with strict adherence to a valid need and truthfulness, then how much easier is it to understand that stating lofty points of wisdom, pertinent to addressing true needs, couched in exceedingly expressive and eloquent composition, which no one can even imagine surpassing in elegance and chasteness, is altogether supernormal and beyond the range of human capacity. Just as experience demonstrates that it is outside the realm of possibility to manufacture a flower similar to the rose externally and internally, so is this impossible too. For, when authentic experience stands as a witness in even minor and trivial matters, and sane nature confirms that if a man wants to have an essential and straightforward conversation, whether it relates to some matter of buying and selling or judicial investigations, with the utmost accuracy in an appropriate manner, it becomes impossible for him to turn his discourse, needlessly and on all occasions, into an appropriate, balanced, lucid, and eloquent expression, and much less to take it to the highest level of lucidity and eloquence. Then how can the discourse of any man combine all these features to achieve the lucidity and unsurpassable eloquence in a composition that, in addition to truthfulness and rectitude, is filled with profound points of wisdom and lofty truths, descends to meet a true need, encompasses all divine verities, does not neglect anything in fulfilling its obligation for the reformation of the prevailing situation, perfectly completes the arguments, fully confutes the deniers, keeps in view all aspects of argumentation and debate, and includes all essential arguments, proofs, teachings, and questions and their answers, despite these intricate difficulties which far exceed the former case, in a manner that is not only incomparably eloquent, but also expresses the subject in a style that cannot possibly be more fluent. These are the properties possessed by Surat al-Fatiha and the Holy Quran, in a manner that has complete resemblance with the incomparable properties of the rose. In addition, Surat al-Fatiha and the Holy Quran have a magnificent attribute that is unique to this holy word, which is that studying it with attention and sincerity purifies the heart, dispels layers of darkness, and expands the mind, and, drawing a seeker after truth towards the Holy One, invests him with such light and manifest signs that are characteristic of those who have attained nearness to the Holy One, and which cannot be acquired by man through any other device or plan. I have also furnished evidence of this spiritual effect in this book, and, if there is a sincere seeker after truth, I can satisfy him in person, and I am ever prepared to furnish fresh and new evidence. Moreover, it needs to be well remembered that the incomparable and unparalleled excellence of the language of the Holy Quran is not confined to rational arguments alone. Rather, valid experience spanning over a lengthy period of time also confirms and substantiates it. For 1300 years, the Holy Quran has been presenting its excellences by beating the drum of "Is there a challenger?" and proclaiming loudly to the whole world that it is incomparable and unparalleled in its external form and internal qualities, and that no man, small or great, has the ability to compete with it or counter it. Yet no one has even dared to take up its challenge. Indeed, no one has been able to compete with even one surah, for example, Surat al-Fatiha, in its external and internal qualities. Look, what could be a more self-evident and manifest miracle than this? Not only does intellect prove that this holy word transcends human capabilities, but experience extending over a lengthy period of time also bears witness to its status as a miracle. Should anyone reject this twofold testimony, proven by intellect and experience, extending over a lengthy period of time, and take pride in his knowledge and his skill, or have faith in someone's writing ability to produce the like of the Holy Quran, I am setting out below some of the verities and subtleties comprised in Surat al-Fatiha by way of illustration, so that such a one may put forward his own composition in an attempt to match the external and internal qualities of Surat al-Fatiha. End quote. Giving a summary of Surat al-Fatiha's subject matter, the Promised Messiah alayhi salam said, "The recitation of Surah Fatiha in prayer is obligatory, and it is this prayer that clearly shows that true prayer is made only in the course of the prayer service. Allah has taught this in this manner. Before supplicating the Almighty, one should praise and glorify Him, so that one's spirit may be uplifted with love and adoration. The Fatiha, therefore, begins with, 'All worthiness of praise belongs to Allah, the Creator and Sustainer of all, who bestows out of His pure grace even before any action or prayer proceeds from His creatures, and then rewards righteous action in this world and in the hereafter also. He is the Master of Judgment. Every requital rests in His hands. Good and evil are in His power. One becomes a full and perfect believer in His unity only when one accepts Allah the Most High as the Master of Judgment. Beware, it is a sin to regard human authorities as all-powerful in their respective spheres of control or authority. This amounts to associating them with God. As God has invested them with authority, they should be obeyed. But do not set them up as gods. Render unto man his due, and render unto God his due. The next stage is of supplication. Thee alone do we worship, and Thee alone do we implore for help. Guide us along the right path, the path of those whom Thou hast favored, that is, the party of the prophets, the faithful ones, the martyrs, and the righteous. In this prayer, the grace and bounty bestowed on all these groups is pleaded for. The supplication proceeds, 'Save us from the way of those who incurred Thy wrath and who went astray.'" End quote. Giving a summary of Surat al-Fatiha's subject matter, Hazrat Muslim Audh said, The topics mentioned in Suratul Fatiha, as is apparent from its name, serve as an introduction to the Holy Quran. The subjects of the Holy Quran have been covered in a concise manner within this chapter. From the very outset of the Holy Quran, the reader is able to understand the summary of its topics that are to be covered in the subsequent chapters. The Holy Quran begins with Bismillah, in the name of Allah, which clearly shows that a Muslim, 1. Possesses firm faith in God Almighty, as the words used are Bismillah. 2. Possesses firm faith that God Almighty is not only the first cause of the universe, as is believed by some philosophers, but He is also the one through whose command and orders the universe continues to function. It is for this reason that His help and succor is of immense benefit to man. 3. Believes that God is not merely a subconscious being. Rather, He is eternal and has the everlasting name Allah. He possesses various attributes, such as the Most Gracious, the Ever-Merciful. 4. Believes that Allah is the source of all progress, and He controls all means through which the world can make progress as manifested by the attribute of the Most Gracious. 5. Believes that Allah has created man to attain the highest stages of progress. When man correctly uses the means that Allah has created, his efforts bring about the best results, which, in turn, make him deserving of ever more divine bounties. This is evident from the attribute of the Ever-Merciful. 6. Believes that there is comprehensiveness and perfection in all the works of Allah, and that He possesses all forms of beauty. He also believes that God alone is deserving of all praise, as all that exists beside Him is created by Him. This is expressed through the words, "All praise belongs to Allah alone, Lord of all the worlds." 7. Believes that, besides Allah, everything which has been created has continuously evolved. All creation began from an inferior being and developed gradually to reach perfection. Thus, Allah the Almighty is the creator of all things, and except Him, nothing else is self-existing. This alludes in the words, "Lord of all the worlds." 8. Believes that the world, which is diverse, has thousands of species of varying dispositions. Hence, to understand the individual species, one must investigate that species alone as opposed to comparing different species to one another. Allah the Almighty deals with every species according to their nature. Therefore, we should not be misled if we find any differences in the dealing of Allah between His creations. As such, difference is due to the diversity between species and not due to injustice and lack of attention on God's part. This notion can be understood from the words, "Lord of all the worlds." 9. Believes that as Allah the Almighty is the creator of all means, He is also the creator of those that utilize these means. Thus, all things at all times stand in need of His help. This alludes to the attribute of the Most Gracious. 10. Believes that just as God Almighty is the creator of all means, and is also the creator of all those that utilize these means, similarly, He also governs the outcome of those means that have been utilized. For example, He has created man and also created the sustenance that is necessary for his survival. Furthermore, the healthy and unhealthy blood which is produced in man's body as a result of the sustenance is also owing to His divine command. This is expressed through God's attribute of the Ever-Merciful. 11. Moreover, God Almighty has also established the system of reward and punishment. A day comes when everything, in accordance with its circumstances, witnesses the full consequences of its good or evil actions. In other words, the consequences of actions are of two types. Firstly, those intermediary consequences which follow all actions to some extent, and secondly, the final consequence which is the cumulative effect of them all. Hence, Allah the Almighty has not only ordained that every action should have a reaction, which God's attribute, the Ever-Merciful, indicates, but He has also ordained that all actions lead to a cumulative consequence. This is why He is called the Master of the Day of Judgment. 12. Hence, only such a being is worthy to be worshipped and deserving of one's love. This is expressed in the words, "Thee alone do we worship, and Thee alone do we implore for help." 13. Further, it is mentioned that human progress depends upon two factors, actions of the body and actions of the heart, the latter signifying contemplation, thought, belief and intention, etc. it is necessary to reform both the actions of the body and the heart. However, this reformation cannot come to be without the guidance of Allah. Hence, the words used are, "Thee alone do we worship, and Thee alone do we implore for help." 14. Then it is said that God Almighty Himself desires that He should meet with His servants and reform them. The only condition is that the servant should incline towards Him and beg to have communion with Him. This is alluded to in the words, "Guide us on the right path." 15. Furthermore, it is said that there are many apparent paths which lead to God. However, it is not sufficient to merely have knowledge of this path. Rather, it is also necessary that firstly, the path ought to be the shortest, so that man should not perish during his struggle to find the right way, as in God. Secondly, this path should be well known, that the past servants that had tread upon this could testify that they had encountered God. As a result of this, the servant may be apprised of the dangers that lay ahead on their journey, and be acquainted with the remedies to these hurdles. In this manner, the heart will remain content and will not lose hope, benefiting from the company of these virtuous servants. Thus, such a path ought to be sought from Allah Almighty in the following words, "The path of those on whom Thou hast bestowed Thy blessings." 16. When man progresses in any field, his heart can be tainted with arrogance and egotism, resulting in his downfall. Hence, one ought to safeguard themselves against these evils. One's progress should not lead them to oppression and disorder. Rather, it should be a means of establishing peace and serving humanity. One should also continuously supplicate to Allah the Almighty for safeguarding against the evil of arrogance. This is alluded to in the words, "Those who have not incurred your displeasure." 17. Just as man can use his position of higher authority to commit injustices, so can he, on account of sympathy and excessive love, unjustly attribute greater status to inferior beings. This should not just be avoided. Instead, one should supplicate to Allah Almighty to achieve the exalted status of those who He has rewarded. At the end of Surah Al-Fatiha, the worshippers say Ameen, which means, "O Allah, accept our supplications." Thereafter, the Imam recites a portion of the Holy Quran. The Imam may choose any portion of the Quran to recite after the Surah Al-Fatiha. When the Imam is reciting a portion of the Holy Quran, the worshippers are required to listen to it silently.